We do have to end this session at a quarter of, so I'm going to get started. I think most people are here and the bell is rung. My name is John Schramm, and Larry introduced this session with the phrase that it's the theme session. I have written the theme on the blackboard. I think most of you are aware of it. If you have been at Holden at least even one day, you're aware of it. It comes from a collect that has been known as the Holden Prayer. Not that we owned it, but that we adopted it as a Holden Prayer. It was both in the red hymnal and now in the green hymnal. So I'd kind of like to start. The reason for the theme session each Sunday is to give people a chance to say what that means to you, what this theme means to you, to clarify how that is a theme for the summer. And before I add to what I think that theme might mean for us, I'd like to have you respond to what it means to you. Get some ideas. Facing the 80s, faith to go out with good courage. What does it say to you as a theme?
Yes. Question. Good courage phrase is intriguing. How does that contrast with bad courage?
Okay. What does it, obviously it's a quote from an old collect. Is there bad courage? What does it say to you when it says good courage instead of just with courage?
I think of it as an uplifting spirit to leave with more, instead of a downcast spirit, to leave with an uplifting spirit.
Right, as the idea of uplifted, right?
To be more positive about the happiness than negative. Like, oh, gee, I teach class. I teach a special ed class. Oh, today's going to be a rocking day or something. Right. Well, today's going to be a great day.
Okay, more positive. Maybe instead of courage that was resignation, it's a more positive courage. I think maybe it's just an old English way of having a colic, but I sounds to me. Is it, where are the tailors here? No. I don't know. What does it say to you? I don't think it's as opposed to bad courage, no. But is it a helpful adjective with good courage?
Well, I might think of the psalm, "This is the day that the Lord hath made, we shall rejoice in it."
All right.
Whatever God has in store for us, it shall be for our good.
Okay.
It just struck me as a word that had to go in to make it flow nicely.
Maybe
somebody had a real meaning.
Dan Erlander, some of Dan Erlander's favorite friends are liturgical archaeologists. And if liturgical archaeologists would dig into it, there may have been a fussy person one time who said it needs a good in there to flow correctly.
A little more pious.
Right?
It has a flavor of awful good.
Awful.
When I say that's an opposite, you know, awful and good. But I say it when I have a delicious dinner. It was awful and good.
All right. How about other aspects of the theme? What does it announce to you? What do you expect to get from a week or a day at Holden when this is the theme? Does it promise, advertise, indicate?
I think the spiritual renewal you get, and the renewal of your faith and the strengthening of your faith.
Okay.
I think that's one day being here, that's what I've already learned and appreciated.
I think of living with hope rather than despair.
All right, hope rather than despair.
Accumulating resources that will be adequate for the road, whatever the road is.
All right, a place of resources for the road, knowing that the point is we're on the road. Not that you are to stay here forever, but the point is to go out. So you got some resources to go out, right?
In that light, John, I think it just turned around, and that is that that in terms of material things, in other resources, things look bleak in the 80s. They're looking bleaker, I should say. And therefore, we will need the faith to face that bleakness. We'll need faith of this type to help us meet the challenge of what is ahead.
All right. Yes.
Faith to me means, too, that I know that God is at work. And I think of a man, I believe he went to Harlem to start a congregation or something, saying that he had this great idea that they were going to help, and then he came to the realization the Holy Spirit had already been working there, and he just needed to recognize it. I guess my faith is that I know God's out there working. I just need to go and recognize it more quickly.
Okay. Good reference, too. If you have not read Bill Weber, those are old books now from the 60s, East Harlem Protestant Parish. He wrote two books, God's Colony in Man's World and Congregation in Mission. And he said, read the second book, not the first one. The first book was written when we thought, a few of us from the seminary, were going to bring Christ to Harlem. The second book was after we had been there and found out he had been working there a long time and that we joined what God was doing in Harlem when we moved there, and it's a better book. That's a very honest kind of statement, all right?
I have a thought.
Yes.
This is kind of corny, but it's something I've heard before. Faith to go out with God's courage. If you take God out of good, what you have is nothing.
Good. All right. Thank you. That fits in. Somebody was asking while she was about to speak. Who did I miss? Yes. I think it's Congregation in Mission. Yeah. It's William Weber. George William Weber. Yes.
The theme seemed really appropriate to me on, I guess it was Tuesday night after the volcano had gone off.
All right.
Kind of wondered what we would face when we went out of this place.
Okay.
That's a question I always ask when I come to Holy. We're so isolated. And what are we going to find in the world when we go back?
All right. Thank you. You that were not here last week, there were some turmoils, there were some differences of opinion. It was a lively week, and to me a very positive week, but in the midst of that, one person complained that it had not been the vacation he had hoped it would be. It seems to me when we choose this theme, first of all, Holden is meant to be a refreshing place, but it is really not a resort. I mean, it is a place to look, not hide from the reality. Facing the 80s does say we're going to face the issues, not hide from them. Facing the 80s means we're going to look to the future, not do a lot of nostalgia, although we did have nostalgia night and it was fun. Faith to go out indicates that Holden has had a phrase for a long time. Holden is a good place to come to only if it's a good place to leave. And that really is the point of having a, quote, place apart. It's not that you come to Holden for some pure spiritual air and then hold your breath out there until you find another place where God is. What you do at Holden is to have the time apart to reflect on the fact that you've been with God at the points where He does meet us in the real crises of the time. Not that you... There is a general impression sometimes that you come to church like a filling station. And some bulletins I've seen have the prelude is a veil that we walk through into this holy space as though God were absent from us the rest of the week. That's very poor theology. I hope the theme indicates to you resources, yes. Clear your eyesight a little bit. Become more aware of God's presence with you where you live. Those kinds of things, I think, are important to the theme. By the way, one group saw faith to go out with good courage as an announcement that we are going out, literally. The end is coming, and it was a group of young blacks. That say anything to you in the United States today? No one else has seen in this the courage to face the fact that it's all over. Let's go out with good courage. It was a group of young blacks who read it that way without any great fuss about it. Thought it was okay to look at it that way. Do it with good courage. One of the forums this week was on the race situation, which I think is worse than it was a decade ago. And if we had lots of people from eastern cities, it would be a daily conversation in this village. We are kind of removed from that, not only by Holden, but by geography of the teeming cities. Washington, D.C. has a budget crunch, and you know the first things that were cut, don't you? All the swimming pools, playgrounds, and programs for youth in a long, hot summer. We do it every time. How about Bill Deal and Mark Gibbs reading it and immediately saying, good, you're going to stress laity. We're the ones who go out. And so it's meant to be the church when you go out. Okay? Does that trigger any more things again before I... It sounds like it offers you something. I don't mean that you're supposed to look at every word and continue to plumb the depths of the theme, but it is meant to focus our time together. Okay. What I'd like to do is to tell you that this morning's session is going to be largely verbal, whereas over half the theme sessions this summer have been visual. We have had a theme movie, Excuse Me, America, in which those who were at Holden that week got introduced to one of my heroes, Dom Elder Câmara, 5'5", Bishop Recife Olinda, Brazil. Seems to me he incarnates this theme. He does not hide from the issues that face him or his country or the poor of his country. His diocese is in the poverty area of Brazil. But he does it with not only good courage, with good humor, with music, with a delightful presence to him. And he was just in Time magazine. His picture is next to the Pope, and apparently the Pope sided at least a little bit with Dom Elder and his emphasis when he went to Brazil, and that pleases me. So it's normally been visual. Today it's verbal. That does not mean I'm going to lecture to you. I'd like to image some possibilities and then have you use our theme to really articulate a sense that we might have at Holden with this theme. I'm really going to let you talk back to someone who shares his life with you. He's a medical doctor. I guess if you were a medical doctor, it might hit a little harder, but I had no trouble relating to him. It seems to me to be one of the most honest appraisals of what life is like today, without self-pity. And I would like you just to begin, as I'm reading it, to begin to formulate what you would like to say to this person on the basis of our theme, assuming that we're going to have something to say in the midst of a world that does, in fact, need lots of faith to go out with good courage. Begin to formulate your answer. I'm a practicing pediatrician, and so though my work is in the world, it also has a scholarly and a reflective side. For the most part, I can handle pretty well the disapproval of those parts of society that I don't respect in the first place, but I have lots of trouble with what I see as my social impotence, and even the connivance of government and the law in causing that condition. Let me give you a few examples. A close friend, a professor of pediatrics, became head of an anti-poverty program run by a university. A lawyer who was prominent in the area arrived with a law book under his arm and also a list of persons who were to be hired for the project. My friend demurred. "I hire on merit," he said. The lawyer then opened his law book. It was hollow, and inside was a .45 automatic. And the lawyer said, "This is the law, now watch it." Within a week, the head nurse was raped on the streets. Two assistants' houses were firebombed. My friend got away with having his automobile's tires shot out and acid poured over his car. He resigned. I was the medical director for a Head Start program for some years. I was never threatened. That came later. I was totally ignored. I would like to think that this was because I'm younger than my friend and have a black belt in judo. I think, however, the real difference was I never had control of the money, and my friend did. After 3 years of frustrated watching, I was able to prove that the health care of the children was an illusion, that the money had been siphoned. My long documented letter to the local federal anti-poverty office led the officials there to ask the medical society's help in throwing me out as a troublemaker. Three. All of these are examples. He simply numbers them. As chief of staff of a local hospital, I became aware that patients were receiving immense bills from another hospital for simple lacerations. On inquiring, I was told beneath that simple healing cut is a wealth of plastic surgery. So it's billed plastic surgery. Since I couldn't take the patients apart, the obvious answer was to check the insurance billing records. If all billing was for plastic surgery, credulity would be strained to the breaking point. The insurance companies refused to release the records. They said the doctors would be, quote, offended, end of quote. As I personally as I've personally been so offended at these organizations that I can hardly see straight, I'm led to conclude that an overwhelming desire not to make waves might have been involved. Following my complaints, the medical group of which I was the managing partner was, over a 9-month period, included in 7 separate audits for the government programs the insurance firms handled. Throughout this time, no funds were forthcoming. The results of 5 of these audits couldn't even be found for 5 months. Computer error, they said. Finally, our attorney, at $100 per hour, 1968 money, parked himself in the front office of the offending organization. Then we were paid within a month. 4. At about this time, the White House asked doctors not to increase fees. We complied. When a mandatory freeze was imposed, we were charging about half the rates of many colleagues. Our expenses were not frozen, so we applied for an exemption. Throughout the freeze, every 45-page application was lost, with no exceptions. The attitude of the bureaucrats over these mishaps was very instructive. Quote, my God, Doc, 1/2, eh? Fill out the forms. We lost the last 2. Laughter. Damn, try again, Doc. 5. I was responsible for attempting to remove an obstetrician from a hospital medical staff, one so incompetent that all the other obstetricians on the staff had written letters saying that they would not operate with him. A hearing must be held on such matters with a duly appointed hearing officer. Following the best advice, we called the local bar association, which sent us our hearing officer. Our fatal blunder now emerged. As one of our charges, the obstetrician's performance of numerous female circumcisions was listed. The hearing officer began with that one, and I would be dignifying his conversation with the doctor by calling it revolting. What emerged was this, quote, it makes them passionate, and I'll do it on your wife. The charges were dismissed. No other discussion took place. My only shard of credit here is that my discussion with the hearing officer caused him to leave the building with some speed. However, the decision stood. Irrespective of the evidence actually considered, again to reverse the usual societal stereotypes, the hospital and medical staff, after once more gathering evidence over the next 2 years, paid $8,000 for a lawyer and $2,500 for a hearing officer, this time a professor of law, and this time the gentleman was nailed. Call it a draw, though, he continued to practice in the community, just not in that particular hospital. I can hear your response to my tales of woe. Take it to the public. I tried that. I quickly gathered support. It turned out that most of my supporters simply wanted to divert hospital funds to their own use. It took me well over a year to divest myself of my support. The problems never did get solved. The image of social reformer as prophet has been illusory in my life. I submit that on the day-to-day confrontation with specific problems, and that includes following through until you know whether you really accomplished anything or not, society has ground to a halt. I agree with Woody Allen's judgment. The lion shall lie down with the calf, but the calf will not get much sleep. The anti-poverty program run by the gentleman with the 45 continues. The nailed obstetrician continued to practice until he overdosed himself with drugs. The difficulties of knowing whether you've done much practical good in the world are insurmountable on 2 levels. First, what one accomplishes, if anything, is lost in the actions of the rest of society. And 2, one's personal life goes to pot in the struggle. I've known too many missionaries and too many activists. A few avoid this pitfall, I'm sure. I've never met one who has. Either the wife pulls out because daddy is a megalomaniac, or the kids have learning disabilities. Alas, I'm on the side of the missionary. Will you speak to my friend here? Will you think of the last sermon you heard that tried to speak and try to image for me how it sounds?
His remarks are not unusual. I'm a practicing physician.
Okay.
And the hospital 10 years ago, first time we'd ever turned off someone that applied for an application for staff privileges. And it was a woman, she was foreign born, foreign trained. And we went through lawsuits, and it took almost 8 years until it was finally solved. And I don't know how much it cost the hospital and legal fees to keep her off the staff. We did the right thing because she wasn't an incompetent person, but it was woman's rights, and one thing were involved. She was a foreigner, we were discriminating against her for that reason. And it was the most difficult thing.
Okay. Do you have anything to say to him?
Yes. One general theme is, where is the community of support for a man in that kind of predicament?
Okay.
The image comes to my mind as somebody sitting on a limb and the tremendous turmoil, the burnout question comes into being, which you identified already.
Yeah.
The missionary kind of thing. He's at a crux of deciding whether or not my conscience and my being, my holistic approach to the world, and it sounds like he's at, is about at either a standstill or do I go on? And where do I have the nourishment to go on? That I raise that is, what kind of nourishment can we get?
Okay.
And where?
Where is his support community? Or are you sewing? Or are you okay? When I'm up here, it's like an auction. Don't scratch your ears. Yeah.
He seemed to have an incredible streak of bad luck. And I'd like to think there are some communities in the country where he would have gotten a better hearing, a fairer hearing, and he would have attracted more unselfish support.
Okay.
No. Still, I feel that this is true, and not only the field of medicine, but the field of law and business and politics and everything, education and
education. Two different responses. Did you hear them? Perhaps maybe the vacuum. Well, they probably do have to get it done. Don't stop them. I'll just if you all speak a little louder, we'll both get the rooms clean for the people coming in and have a discussion. That this is a little bit extreme. That other places you wouldn't have gotten clobbered in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The other response is it is not dissimilar, however, from the way it is, and not only in the field of medicine, but education, law. So there's kind of mixed reactions to whether it's unusual or whether that's really the way it is now. Those are the two comments. You got any response to that?
Whether it's unusual or usual or not, I don't really see where that's an issue as to whether or not the efforts he made were worthwhile. I would just say, hey, I'm on your side, even if everyone else is giving you a hard time. I'll keep doing it for me, if nothing else.
You would be willing to be part of a support group?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Unselfing.
All right.
I would challenge how many persons really care, either in the consuming public or within the professions themselves. And I happen to be part of a human profession. And it's staggering how people are totally complacent about the process that is going on. And I dare say, even in this group, few would really stand up and want to go to the support of this person. It's pretty scary what he's doing.
Yep.
I'm not sure that I would, as much as I believe in what he's doing.
Did we mean enough good courage to stand with him when the 45 explains how decisions are made, or when your tires are slashed? All right, that's an honest response. What? Can you make? Well, I shouldn't stop. No, you go ahead. I have no need to direct it. I wanted to know what you thought.
Well, it seems that when you come up against a big unmoving bureaucracy, I mean, these things have a habit of I don't know how to put it, you hit it,
yep,
and it just absorbs everything. It's just like a bowl full of jelly. It's there. There's a certain inertia that just stays. I think that's the most frustrating thing about huge organization, huge government, huge whatever it is.
Well, the thing is, if you go into a huge organization and try to hit them head on, you're only going to spatter your head because they know the game better than you do. I work in a bureaucracy, and there are these kinds of things happening that you know, turns around and they try and eat you up on. But there are ways also of playing, of stepping aside and hitting other than head on. Head on, you're never going to get anywhere unless you've got a whole battery of lawyers and all kinds of kind of money in the world. But bureaucracies can be made to move, to adjust, and to listen. It's not easy, and it can be very exasperating, but they can bend. Not great, but bend.
Okay, so part of it might be to sit and strategize with it. I think that's a reasonable response.
I mean, if you're not as masterful about it, you know, if you don't know how to play chess, the dumbest thing you do is to go against a master, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to play something, don't take on the master and try to beat them. Take it on in a course that they're not so masterful in playing.
Now I am going to get back to what I was going to ask before. Do you think his local congregation is the group to help him strategize on those politics? Have you ever been in a church that you could expect both the people to stand with you in the risk and the people who would understand how to strategize here and have good courage? You think it should? Okay.
Dan mentioned yesterday that we argued whether or not we should even talk about such issues.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a debate. That's where the energy goes. So that we can talk about
this. Let me tell you the last thing that I heard specifically as a kind of response to living in this kind of world. It just happened that when Mary and I were out, the last thing I heard, other than Holden, where I have part in shaping what's said, I didn't get to go to church. We were out only 48 hours. I saw one bumper sticker with Jesus, every day is nice. How do you like that one as an answer to you? We smile at that one. You think of all the sermons you've heard that are not quite that simplistic, that say almost the same thing, and we do not smile about them, and you'll realize part of our problem. That's a judgment on, and preach. Some preachers are some of my best friends. Some of my best friends are preachers. We really have a difficult time wrestling with this thing, and some people, this man included, should be incensed with what's preached as the gospel for his situation. Cheap posters, when you get a lemon, make lemonade. How would you like to hand him that as a gift after he just spilled his guts? Or bloom where you're planted, but don't expect me to stand there with you. Don't we really give some pious advice instead of support-based? Larry.
It's much the same comment. I was just going to ask, what is the faith that he can draw upon in the presentation in the congregation? And it strikes me that the kind of advice that or support we would verbally give is encouragement, but it's so shallow. I mean, we would say, stick in there, or something like that. It isn't a presentation of the faith that has any depth to meet ongoing failure and tragedy.
Yeah.
If we do want to be a support with the things in there, then it's going to have to be some other understanding of the faith.
Okay.
Than to tell people to things will look up.
The reason I keep saying that I kind of apologize that today's all verbal. The beauty of the visual, and we had to send the film back. The beauty of the visual is it includes Dorothy Day with food kitchens and soup kitchens and feeding the poor since 1930. Mother Teresa, who continues every day to pick up the dime. I mean, where does she get the sustaining power to do that? Cesar Chavez, who did take on a system. He's the most controversial in the thing. Somebody walked out of the movie and said, that's politics, that movie, and someone had the grace and the theology behind to say, it certainly was. It was the politics of Jesus. That was an interesting dialogue one morning. But anyway, visually, to see some people who do not give pious advice but stand as symbols of faith to go out with good courage, that's why we got the film for as long as we can. But anyway, now there are some other hands. Fritzy.
I think it takes more courage to support someone than it does to be the initiator.
All right.
And I don't know, but what, in order to get support, you have to go become even more basic than just talking about faith or courage. If you've ever supported someone wholeheartedly and been double-crossed, you get extremely leery. And if you have ever even listened to someone who becomes the town crackpot, but you believed them the first few times and you see other people believing, you become pretty leery. And unfortunately, we have very strong and effort-sounding people in the churches, too.
Okay. Just a minute. Nyla first. In the balcony, you may sometimes have to speak up because my visual doesn't always.
From your description of this pediatrician, my mindset saw him as a man. But I wonder if, and I don't know if it was signed or what, but.
No, it was the black belt in judo that gave you the image of a man.
Yeah, but let's think about this person as a woman,
right.
And then I was trying to think of the comments in terms of this person being a woman, and that adds another dimension as far as family and doing something and having leaving your family or whatever, the children having learning disabilities.
Yeah.
I mean, things we laugh about in that. Just adds another dimension to it.
Daniel Berrigan once said, there are no prophets with a wife and four children, or he could have said a husband and four children. And he didn't mean that facetiously. I mean, I think that is a factor. Yeah. Somebody had a hand up when I went to the balcony. No? Yes?
I guess I wanted to say that courage means to me that you really don't care if what you have to say with faith, whether somebody else, you know, who disagree don't like it a lot.
All right.
And I guess I'm saying that out of a experience of a burnt out person who will continue to go out with courage and with my faith.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I think that we have to have a little bit of a positive thing that you know, in the very upper echelons of our society, we did, in the 70s, remove a president who wasn't doing right.
Yes.
So up there, there is a positive reaction to wrong.
You mean you can show sometimes when people who had moral indignation did in fact change something, even big bureaucracies. Am I reading you right? And a president did resign. Okay. So you find your illustrations of courage wherever you can get them. And the Psalms are partly that, are they not? Remembering times when justice was done. And so you find Larry's theme session last week said you remember those times and you keep those stories alive. All right, good. Yeah.
This week in the Bible study, we were dealing with the Anoim.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, there's an Anoim here in terms of this doctor. I mean, I suspect he still has courage.
Yeah.
But he feels almost alone, as the poor did in terms of the Bible. So maybe there's an Anoim remnant here.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. I'd like to explore Berrigan's comment.
Okay.
Because I think it hits me.
All right.
And the first comment that comes to me is, if you have a family, you'll lose your nerve.
Mm-hmm.
You throw the towel in a lot sooner in behalf of my kids, my wife, less time for this, less time for that. I think that's an incredibly important dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
That families face in that process, and I raise that along with where the nurture and continuance of the family and the time to do the work and the problem of separating that work from family, you know, the compartmentalization that we set up. You know, I do my family life here, and then I do my mission work here, if you're into the thing, and the trouble to make the connection between them. I say that's a crucial issue.
Yeah.
It is for my life.
Yeah.
You know, I let the young unmarried. The issue of celibacy is potentially real on that question.
Yeah.
And but then do we cop out on kids and everything else in that process? It's better not to have kids nowadays because you know, we know what's coming, kind of thing. So we cop out on life on that. That's maybe too many questions, but I think the woman's question, if there is in that regard, I think.
Yeah, understand the comment about the having children and therefore having that as part of your life, part of the givens, and then what that does in the way of being the reason that you don't risk, or that's a real dilemma. One of the really fine aspects of a forum on singles was that the church, by and large, has seen the singles as a quote problem because we're oriented toward families, and the most we do is have a singles group. Instead of reeling, and the singles were there talking, instead of realizing the possibilities for ministry that sometimes singles are freed to do because they do not have family. The same thing could be talked about celibate clergy and the freedom then of both movement and not worrying about. Mary and I moved from D.C. partly because we had four kids in that school system for a long time, and we wanted them, frankly, to have something other than inner city D.C. as school. They had 7 years of that, and we wanted that to not be their only experience. We moved partly because of our kids. Sure, I'll acknowledge that. And now we know how often they were scared. They didn't tell us. They've now said, we knew you wanted to stay in the city, so we didn't tell you. And they really were scared often. I think I'd have not slept so well if the kids had not kept from mom and dad what really went on in those schools. It is a dilemma. It was and has been a personal one for me. Yeah.
We've assumed all the way through this that, you know, there's righteousness against the system or something like that. It strikes me that maybe the frightening thing about all of this is not so much that he tried and failed, but that all those people that made it impossible for him to accomplish what he was trying to accomplish are probably in the front pew of the church every Sunday morning.
Yeah.
That's the frightening thing. The arbitrator and the bureaucrat and everyone else, the hospital board and so forth, those are not necessarily made up of people that are demonic.
Yeah, okay. Lest somebody may have to leave before quarter of. I hope you don't. I'm coming back to him. He really does have some answers. I've just excerpted. The title is Morals, Medicine, and Monasticism. You'll be surprised, maybe, where he gets his strength. It's a beautiful testimony, and I'll come back to him. So that keeps you here till a quarter of. I'd like to give you a couple other people, verbally, that I think help with this theme and with what we're trying to do this morning. One is Dan Berrigan. Obviously, he's been a controversial figure. If you don't know what Dan Berrigan like, that is one of my favorite photographs of him. I have met him. I respect him. I think when the records are written, he will have been one of the prophetic voices of this past decade. If you want to get to know him in a less political and explosive way, read Uncommon Prayers, where he rewrites some psalms. Beautiful, beautiful poetic sense of the psalms. But anyway, he's being interviewed by someone who sees him mostly as a political figure instead of seeing him as a monk. And you will never understand Dan Berrigan if you don't understand that he is essentially a monk. So the conclusion to what I'm going to read is one of the ironies that I really like. But the substance of his first response, I think, speaks to our theme. You seem optimistic about the possibility of public resistance finally stopping the arms race and doing something. Where do you get this optimism? Dan Berrigan says, this has nothing to do with optimism. It's hope. Hope is different from optimism. Hope is a gift. I have never been allowed optimism. I have never seen things going well. I've seen only the continuous expansion of targets, the poor, the innocent, the unborn, continuous evidence of blunting our humanity. In my childhood, nuclear war or the Holocaust were unimaginable. If I were to slog along in the political situation as it is commonly understood, I would have gone under long ago. The believing community has an entirely different basis that has nothing to do with cultural promises or political expectation. For us, it has to do with the promises of Jesus Christ. It has to do with looking for acts of God, for God's intervention. We're looking for this act of God in our own lives. Hope is the interplay between trust in the promises of Christ and the willingness to embody these promises in the way we live, and in our resistance to the rule of death in the world. What we do at the Pentagon, he was asked why they go and protest at the Pentagon. What we do at the Pentagon is for me an experience of hope. And it is a great act of hope to go back and back and back, to sing, to offer a message that there is another way, to keep trying to dissolve the boundaries. Question. Now what of your own future? Berrigan. No different from the past. Opportunity for more growth, for more prayer, and for more salvation. Do you have political plans? Those are the political plans. Are you sure? Absolutely. Where till the end? The interviewer never understood. That is my politics. I've just told you my politics. To pray and to sing. Okay. I would like to do one more thing before we get back to the pediatrician. Last week, in the midst of someone saying it wasn't really the vacation they had hoped, they used this same phrase, if you don't have some optimism when we're at Holden Village, then we would not be renewed. I'd like to speak to that in the light of this theme. Seems to me that this theme assumes a Lutheran type of theology of the cross instead of a theology of glory. And since those words are not so easy to understand when you first hear them, in fact, they usually are misunderstood when you first hear them. Theologians of the cross, people say, oh, you mean gloomy ones, gloomy people. And theologians of glory, oh, you mean happy Christianity. That is not correct. But unfortunately, with Luther's use of those two words and the commonest use of those, you tend to think theologians of the cross are pessimistic. Now, is Holden pessimistic or not? Or optimistic? And those are not the best ways to speak to that. I would like to share with you some tough theology three paragraphs of it. I'm going to ask you to listen intently. Douglas John Hall, and I think this is a helpful theological verbal image for our theme. There is no immediate connection between pessimism and the theology of the cross. That's his premise. There is no immediate connection between pessimism and the theology of the cross. Every theological posture has its danger. And no doubt the danger peculiar to the theology of the cross is that it readily lends itself to religious pessimism. That's true. Or melancholia and despair. But something altogether disruptive must happen to the theology of the cross before it can become the vehicle of a religious pessimism. That is, now it's in italics. Douglas John Hall's trying to say to the reader, get this next point. It must cease to be a Christology. I'm going to say that three times. The only way theology of the cross gets changed into pessimism is if you take Jesus out. Can you hear that? I'm not going on until you hear that. If you just sit and look at me, I'm going to say it until we eat. The only way, or the primary way, to misunderstand theology of the cross and have it become instead a kind of pessimism is to remove Jesus Christ. Then, yes, then what do you have left? Okay, now he goes on for a paragraph. It is clear a theological understanding of that as I've ever read. And if there's any heritage, I don't mean to say we're all Lutherans. Douglas John Hall isn't. But when we invited him to be on faculty, he said, you Lutherans have something. Just don't let the church lose Luther's understanding of theology of the cross. If there's any theology we need for this next decade, the 80s, you Lutherans are supposed to be the ones who know that. And I'm not sure we keep it alive very well. It must not be overlooked that the whole intention of this theology is to bear witness to the incarnation. We just had Christmas in July. That's theology of the cross time because it's incarnation time. The theology of the cross is first of all a way of speaking about the character of God's entry into the sphere of human history. The bumper sticker was not only simplistic, it's bad theology. God does not meet us most clearly in our successes and in our, quote, nice days. That's not the biblical message. That's an aside. You can tell when I look up that it's me. For the sake of the tape, this is not all Douglas John. It is not merely a statement about the death of Jesus. It's a statement about his life and the meaning of his life for our lives. It is not merely a statement about the human condition. It is a testimony to the assumption, and that's in quotes, to Jesus assuming it, not assumption meaning a thing I'm coming with in the way of a premise. The assumption of the human condition by the one who created and creates out of nothing. Now, the basic point of the theology of the cross is not to reveal that our condition is one of darkness and death. It is to reveal to us the one who meets us in our darkness and death. You don't need a theology to say we live in darkness and death. You need only the Wenatchee World this morning, or TV, or our corporate sinfulness at Holden Village. You don't need anything else to tell you we're living in a time of facing darkness and death, including the desert of my own soul, for heaven's sakes. The theology of the cross is about the one who meets us there. Not somewhere else, but there. Not after we get perfected. Not after my pimples are gone or anything else. But who I am and where I am. That's the theology of the cross. And that's not pessimistic. Okay. I'm almost preaching. I can feel it. And this is Dan's day. It is a theology of the cross. Not because it wants to put forward a ghastly spectacle as the final statement about life in the world, but because it insists that God, who wills to meet us, love us, redeem us, meets, loves, and redeems us precisely where we are, in the valley of the shadow of death. When Ferdy wrote his book on the theology of the cross, he picked a good title, Where God Meets Man. That's what Theology of the Cross is all about. Where does our Lord meet us? And he meets us at the point of our need and where we really are. In this kind of neighborhood, doing this kind of medicine. That's where God meets us. You don't give that as a pious sermon. You stand there with this person, but it's sure helpful to have your theology straight if you're going to continue to be there. Okay? It is a repudiation of a theology of glory, not because it is masochistic and mistrust or despises man's search for happiness, but, and every time, Paul is really on target when he sets things, but because it insists that authentic happiness can be found only as we confront and enter into that which under the conditions of existence negates and dispels happiness, like blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the hungry, blessed are the persecuted. You don't have to get out of that condition until you find God. God finds us where we are. The theology of the cross declares God is with you, Emmanuel. He is alongside you in your suffering. He has another paragraph, but I'm not going to read that. Excellent theological understanding of theology of the cross, which seems to me is one of the reasons that we have that theme and one of the purposes for Holden Bill.
Okay, I got one of the book, please.
Lighten Our Darkness, Douglas John Hall. This was the theme book for Holden 2 summers ago, and really is that theology is still the theology of Holden and is the theology of the Lutheran Church, but the book itself was the theme book 2 years ago. Now I want to share with you so that you don't miss out on this man, the rest of this man's testimony, which I find very helpful. This was, by the way, in Christian Century, and it's called Morals, Medicine, and Monasticism by James Miller. It was January 23rd of this year, January 23, 1980, Christian Century. The very beginning of the article, he says, increasingly of late, I find myself muttering, for all the good I've accomplished, I should have been a monk. And when I say this, I've always said it in a negative sense, like withdrawing from the world. What he really comes to at the end is that he will be a monk. And I like the end of the article very much. One of the things that he did is, for me now the divine offices or the canonical hours of the medieval church give me some sacred time every day. He went back to, and he names them, he's an Episcopalian, morning and evening prayers in compline. He keeps 3 offices every day, and he calls that some of his sacred time. How formal, you say. Why not pray using your own words? His answer, that's fine, I do that too, but the old medieval logic seems more clear to me. When society is highly structured, as in Puritan America, free prayers may break through, but our society is not structured except insofar as computers can accomplish it. And so I draw upon the church in several thousand years of experience. And he goes through some old medieval monastic offices every day. Now he gets to some other things that he said. Creativity, to me, is taking what both disturbs and exalts you, internally and externally, and wrestling with it, reforming it, until somehow you have altered both it and yourself. It is the refusal, to accept at a gut level what other people say is to be important. I seem to have come almost full circle. I began by complaining that my best efforts led to nothing, except possibly defensive hostility. I am now advising that one's best efforts must finally be judged by wholly different standards. At the end of the article, you have a pediatrician who is now also a contemplative. And that's what we're called to be. Faith is being a contemplative, and contemplation is not living in constant religious ecstasy with your eyeballs rolled up, seeing some other world. It's seeing this one differently. That's a big difference. He's that kind of contemplative. And finally, he has a different sense and a different way of measuring. And he has some, and he capitalizes it in quotes, some sacred time. And he has some other ways to measure. When Mother Teresa was asked last week in Time magazine, how can you keep going? how can you keep doing this? She said, I was never called to be successful, I was called to be faithful. She just has another way of measuring her day. Was I faithful or not? If you were called to be successful, you would have to depend upon the barometers of, quote, success, and have to have some reason for optimism, meaning it's going to work. If you have a different interior understanding of what it means to be faithful, you have a different way of measuring success. In the midst of that, do not let me say that the very first response is not an essential one. I know of no one that I've ever met who can stand as a contemplative and also a solitary. I can't. I want my church, you, to stand there with me. I want some other people who measure with a contemplative vision. I want some other people, when I have compline, to share the sacred time. I think, and you can decide then whether Holden's director is pessimistic or optimistic. Last year the kitchen had a running debate on that all summer. Is John Schramm basically pessimistic or optimistic? And I won't tell you how it came out. You decide. I think the next decade is going to be tougher than the last two. I think facing the 80s, when Larry and I picked that, we're assuming it's going to be some time for good courage, whatever the good means for each other. I think some strong courage and some positive courage, but some courage. I think the nature of the day is such, and the nature of the times are such, globally and here in the United States, that there's going to be tests for our faith. I think it's a time to have deep roots, theologically and scripturally, and to understand some things about the nature of faith in tough times. And when you find some people who incarnate that, and especially find that support group, even if it's Job's friends, even if this guy had some people that didn't say anything but were standing there, it would help. Job's friends did fine for the first week, and then they said something. Go back and read them. So don't be so quick to think you have to preach. Just stand there, or just grab a hand sometime. I think the communion of saints is going to be more and more important for us, and that's what Holden is really all about, to strengthen parishes. Where we find that support base, or where we have a right to at least expect it. That you've got some verbal images, a couple sermons, a little chance to respond, and I hope heard from a man that at least stimulated you with the possibilities of the good courage needed in the kind of world in which he lives, and maybe all of us are going to face a little bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.